The Fuller Memorandum, Disc 8.
Mo listens to her phone in disbelief.
They what? She demands.
They left the paperclip attached to a book in Putney Library, says Angleton with icy dignity. A copy of Beasts, Men and Gods by Ferdinand Ossendowski.
Then you've lost him.
Unless you have any better ideas.
Let me get back to you on that.
She snaps her phone closed and glances across the table. An idea is taking hold.
Who's that?
Asks Panin.
If you do not mind.
It was Angleton. The memorandum is still missing. The enemy identified his tracer and neutralized it.
You have my sympathies.
Do you have a car? Because if so, I'd appreciate a lift home, if you don't mind.
10 minutes later, the black BMW with diplomatic plates is slowly winding its way between traffic calming measures. Mo leans back, holding her violin case, and closes her eyes. It's a big car, but it feels small with the driver and a bodyguard up front, and Panin sitting beside her in the back.
Do you have anything in mind?
Panin asks quietly.
Yes.
She doesn't open her eyes. Angleton drew a blank, trying to trace the missing document, but that's not the only asset the cultists have got their hands on.
Your husband.
Panin's nostrils flare.
Do you have a tracer on him by any chance?
No.
She doesn't bother to explain that laundry operatives don't routinely carry bugs, because what one party can track, others may pick up. However, he has a mobile phone.
They'll have switched it off or discarded it.
The former, I hope. If so, I can trace that.
The shiny beetle-black car double parks outside a nondescript row of terrace houses.
Please wait. I'll only be a minute,
she adds as she climbs out. 90 seconds later, she's back, her go bag weighing slightly more heavily on her shoulder. Laptop, she explains.
Your superiors let you take classified documents home.
Panin raises an eyebrow.
No, it's his personal one. He paired it with his phone, which is also a personal device.
She belts herself in, then opens the laptop screen.
All right, let's see.
She slides a thumb drive into the machine, rubs her thumb over a window in it.
Now this is a secured memory stick loaded with execute-in-place utilities. Nothing exotic, mind you, strictly functional stuff. Ah, yes. At the end of the road, turn left.
The driver doesn't speak, but he has no trouble understanding her directions in English. The car heads south, slowly winding its way through the evening streets. Mo busies herself with a laptop, a route finder program, and a small charm on the end of a necklace, which she dangles above the screen, a ward taken from around her neck.
It's along here somewhere,
she says, as the car cruises yet another twisting residential street, where large houses are set back behind tall hedges.
Whoa, we've gone past it. Okay, pull in here.
She pulls out her phone and speed dials a number.
Yes?
Angleton is alert.
I'm in Hazelhurst Road, near Lambert Cemetery, with Nikolai and his driver. Tracking Bob's personal phone. How soon can you meet me here?
Hold on.
Pause.
We'll be there in 15 minutes. Rolling now. Can you wait?
Mo glances sidelong at Panin, who shakes his head slowly.
I don't think so, she says. Nikolai has urgent business elsewhere.
She pulls the door latch, and it swings open with the sluggish momentum of concealed armor plate. She extends one foot to touch the pavement.
I'll be discreet.
Goodbye, Dr. O'Brien, and good luck.
Most of the houses on this road are detached, sitting in pricey splendor on plots of their own, a few downmarket Siamese twin semis lowering the Millionaire Row tone. It's London, but upmarket enough that the houses have private drives and garages. Mo walks slowly back along the pavement until she comes level with the hedge outside a semi with a built-in garage, probably dating to the mid-1930s. The ward throbs in her hand as she reluctantly fastens the fine silver chain around her neck and tucks it in. This is the place. She's sure of it. She pulls out her phone, dials again, says,
Number 34,
then puts it away. Then she opens her go bag and pulls out a pair of goggles. She pulls them on and flicks a switch. Then she stalks around the side of the house. There is a bad smell from the drains out back, and the lawn is unmown. The hedge has not been trimmed. It looms over the overlong grass like the dark and wild beard of the god of neglect. The windows of the house are dark, and not merely because no lights shine within. It's strangely difficult to see anything inside. Mo stares at the flagstoned patio beneath the French doors through her goggles. They are goggles of good and evil, part of the regular working equipment of the combat epistemologist, and their merciless contrast reveals the stains of an uneasy conscience mixed with the cement that binds the stones. It's an upmarket Cromwell Street scene, she realizes, her stomach churning. The police forensic teams will be busy here later in the week, as the tabloid reporters buzz round their heads like bluebottles attracted to the rotting cadavers beneath their feet. Mo moves further around the house. A sense of foreboding gathers like static beneath the anvil cloud of a thunderstorm. Her heart is beating overly fast, and her palms are clammy. She is certain that Bob's phone is here, and where goes the phone goes the Bob. But this is not a good place. Suddenly, she is acutely aware that she is on her own, the nearest backup 10 minutes away. Well then. There is a quiet click as she unfastens the latches of her instrument case. Moments later, the bow is in her hand, the chin rest clamped between her jaw and shoulder. The case dangles before her chest, two compact speakers exposed. There's a sticker on the back of the instrument. It reads, "This machine kills demons." Mo walks towards the glass doors, on the indistinct shadows behind them, and touches her bow to the strings of the pallid instrument. There is a sound like a ghost's dying wail as the strings begin to vibrate, blurring and glowing as they slice the air to shreds. "Open," she says quietly. And as she sounds a chord, the glass panes shatter simultaneously, and the door frame warps towards her. She advances into the suburban dining room, playing raw and dissonant notes of silence to confront the horrors within. The BMW is half a mile away when Panin leans forward and taps his driver on the shoulder.
"Sir?"
The driver glances at Panin's reflection in his mirror. A blank business card appears between Panin's fingertips, twin to one Panin passed to an unwitting contact a couple of days ago.
"Track this," he says.
"Yes, sir."
The driver reaches back and takes the card, then places it on the dashboard in front of him. It glows faintly in the darkened interior of the car. After a moment, they pull over. Then the driver performs a U-turn and accelerates.
"If you don't mind me asking, sir."
"Yes?"
Panin looks up from the map book on his lap.
"Do you want me to call for backup?"
"When we know where we're going, Dmitri. Patience."
"Sir, shouldn't you have told?"
"The wolf may not bite the hound, but that doesn't make them friends. I intend to get there first, Dmitri, wherever there is."
"Then I shall drive faster, sir."
The saloon accelerates, heading south.
"Hello, Bob," says Jonquil's mummy. A small crinkling the crow's feet at the corners of her eyes. "Oh dear, what did you do to your arm? Let me have a look at that."
She tuts over the state of Julian's first aid. Very rough and ready, a wadded-up rugby sock held in place by tubi grip, now black with clotted blood.
"You really ought to have taken the week off sick. Overwork will be the death of you, you know."
"Fuck off!"
Fury and pain give way to a mix of disgust and self-contempt. I should have seen this coming.
"Do feel free to let it all hang out," she tells me. "It's not as if you've got anything to lose, is it?"
Damn Iris. She knows me well enough to get under my skin.
"You've been studying me, haven't you?"
"Of course." She glances over her shoulder.
"You, fetch the first aid kit at once."
Back to me.
"I'm sorry about that. Does your idiot daughter always go around chopping up strangers when you're not around?"
"Yes," she says calmly. "It runs in the family. I don't think you have any grounds to complain, given what you did to poor Gareth. Would you like me to take those handcuffs off you? Don't get any silly ideas about escaping. The guards upstairs will shoot anyone they don't recognize."
"I didn't do anything to Gareth," I say, as she pulls out a key and holds it up in front of me between two black-gloved fingers. If he hadn't meddled... I stop. There's no point arguing. What do you want from me?
Your cooperation for the time being. Nothing more, nothing less.
There's a click, and my right wrist flops free. My arm flares for a moment, and I nearly black out.
That looks painful. Would you like something for it?
I don't remember nodding, but a subjective moment later I'm sitting up on the trolley, and someone I can't see is leaning over me with a syringe. It stings, cold as it goes in. Then my arm begins to fade, startlingly fast.
It's just morphine, Bob. Say if you need some more.
I'm nodding. What do you want?
Come and sit with me, she says, beckoning.
An unseen minion lifts me with an arm under my left shoulder and guides me towards one of two reclining leather armchairs in the middle of a dim pool of light on the flagstones.
Flagstones? Where are we? And I'll explain.
I fade in and out for a bit. When I'm back again, I find I'm sitting in one of the chairs. There's a tight bandage on my right arm, with something that isn't a rugby sock under it. My hands are lying on the armrests, uncuffed, although I've got sore red bands where the metal cut into my wrists. I can feel my fingers, mostly. I can even make them flex. And for the first time in hours, my arm isn't killing me. I'm aware of the pain, but it feels as if it's on the other side of a thick woolen blanket. Iris is sitting in the other chair, holding an oddly shaped cup made of what looks like yellow plastic, watching me. She's put her hair up and changed from her usual office casual into what my finely tuned fashion sense suggests is either a late Victorian morning gown or a cultist priestess's robes. Or maybe she's just come from a goth nightclub with a really strict dress code. I stare past her. We're in a cellar, sure enough, one designed by an architect from the C of E School of Baroque Cathedral Design. It's all vaulted arches and flying buttresses, carved stone and heavy wooden partitions cutting us off from darkened naves and tunnels, just like being in church, except for the lack of windows. Pooty and angels flutter towards the shadowy ceiling. There are rows of oak pews blackened with age. Where are we? I ask.
We're in the underground chapel of the Ancient and Honourable Order of Wheelwrights, she says. They had an overground chapel too, but this one is more private.
I stop. Were the ancient whatevers a cover organisation by any chance? For a brotherhood of a different hue? Iris seems amused by the idea.
Hardly. They were purged in the 1890s, but nobody found the way down to this cellar. We had rather a lot of cleaning up to do. Interminable reconsecrations and exorcisms before we could dedicate the chapel to its true calling.
She pulls a face.
Skull worshippers.
Skull worshippers? Does she mean... Oh dear. There are as many species of cultists as there are dark entities for them to wank over. If this place has a history of uncanny worship going back a century and a half, then it's a place of power indeed. And that's before you take into account its location inside a huge graveyard, at one end of a ley line leading into the heart of London that was traversed by tens of thousands of dead over a period of nearly 100 years. The whole thing has got to be a gigantic necromantic capacitor.
So it was vacant and your people moved in?
More or less, yes. Your people being, officially the Free Church of the Universal Kingdom? Or unofficially... She shakes her head.
The Free Church aren't terribly useful over here. The British aversion to wearing one's religion on one's sleeve, you know. We'd get lots of very funny looks indeed if we went around fondling snakes and preaching the prosperity gospel, even though that sort of thing is de rigueur for stockbrokers. No, on this side of the pond we mostly use local conservative and unionist party branches, and some labour groups, we're not fussy.
Enlightenment dawns, and it's not welcome. Firstly, the Tory grassroots are notorious for their bloody-minded independence. Their local branches pretty much run themselves. And secondly, political leverage. Isn't the Prime Minister very big on community and faith-based initiatives? Oh dear fucking hell. I blink owlishly. Iris leans forward, concerned.
Would you like a can of Red Bull? I'm sure you could do with a pick-me-up.
I nod, speechless. Why me? I ask, as a male minion, wearing a long black robe, naturally, sweeps forward with a small silver tray on which is balanced a can of energy drink. I stare at it and twitch my right hand. He opens the ring pull and holds the tray in front of my functioning left hand. I take the can gratefully and manage to get most of a mouthful down my throat rather than down my t-shirt. As he steps back, I repeat my question. Why did you abduct me? Because I'm quite clear now that this little charade is all about me. We've all been suckered. Iris is one of the two sharpest managers I've ever had, the other being Angleton, and she's been one step ahead of us all along. She probably swiped Moe's report, too. Why? I'm a nobody. You underestimate your value, Bob. She raises her cup and smiles over its rim as she takes a sip of something dark. I blink, focusing on it. That's not a cup, I realize with a sense of detachment. Why is she drinking from a... Because she's a cultist, idiot. You've been fast-tracked for senior management for the past 8 years. You knew that, didn't you? But you're only graded as an SSO3. That's a bit low for someone who's reporting directly to a DSS, so I did some digging. You're not being held back. It's just that the laundry operates a Y-shaped promotion path. Administration and line ranks diverge above a very low level. You're due for regrading later this year, Bob. If you pass the board, they'll make you an SSO4L. Doesn't sound like much, but it's the first step up from the fork into the line hierarchy, and it'll entitle you to boss army majors around, or police superintendents. I'm an SSO6A, but you'd be able to tell me what to do. And a year after that, unless you really go off the rails, they'll be coaching you for SSO5L. I try not to boggle openly. I haven't been paying too much attention to my grade, frankly. I get regular yearly pay raises and rung increments, and I knew I was up for promotion sooner or later, and I knew about the Y path, but it hadn't occurred to me that I might be about to effectively jump 3 grades. I've seen your confidential record, Bob. It's impressive. You get stuff done, and Angleton thinks very highly of you. Angleton. You know what that means, don't you? I nod. My mouth is dry and I feel my pulse fluttering. You didn't infiltrate the laundry just to get close to me, did you? She chuckles. No, Bob, we didn't. We? Oh, holy fuck. There's more than one cultist infiltrator in the laundry. I swallow. But I've been looking for someone like you for a long time. You're on track for executive rank when the stars come right. You lucky, lucky man. Her voice drops to a low croon as she raises the baby's skull and drains it, then holds it out for a refill. It won't work, of course. It won't... Excuse me? Everything. She shrugs. The effect is rather fetching, if you have a goth fixation. Go on, tell me what you think is coming up next. Oh, hell. This is the point, I say guardedly, where the evil cultist monologues at the captive agent and tries to convert him to her way of thinking. It never works. Does it? Iris shakes her head. You're probably right, but I ought to give it a go. Okay, here's my pitch. If I thought for a moment that official policy as set forth in Case Nightmare Green stood a chance of success, if it was remotely possible that we, the human species, could stand shoulder to shoulder against the Elder Ones and build a shield against our Dark Emperor, do you think for a split second that I wouldn't go for it? She looks at me speculatively. You know just how high the odds are stacked against us. There are just too damned many people. We're damaging the structure of reality by over-observing it. And we can't kill them either, not without releasing a pulse of necromantic energy that will have every brain-eater for 1,000 light-years in all directions honing in on us. The latest research... She bites her lower lip. It means the breakthrough is inevitable, and soon. The dead things quicken, and the harder we fight against the inevitable, the worse it will be. She falls silent. Despondent or resigned? What you're saying is... If rape is inevitable, lie back and try to enjoy it, right? She glares at me, blood in her eye for an instant. No, I'm not into enjoying this. I'm interested in survival, Bob, in reaching an accommodation.
Survival at all costs and ensuring the continuity of the human race. That's what the Brotherhood of the Black Pharaoh is about these days. I won't lie to you by denying that our history is ghastly, but we change with the times. Our goal is actually your goal, if you think about it for a moment. Which, for me, is an oh hell statement with brass bells on. It's not as if I haven't had my quiet nagging doubts about the laundry's methods and goals, and its intermittent self-thwarting tendency to substitute circular ass-kicking routines for progress. Iris is goddamn good at what she does. Wasn't I thinking earlier that I'd follow her to hell if I couldn't hear an echo of Mo's voice reminding me the things in the cultists' bodies had already eaten the blonde teacher's face and most of her left leg, but the Somali boy child was still screaming. You used a phrase there, I say quietly. I don't think it means quite the same thing to you that it means to me. At all costs. I put my energy drink can down. I've emptied it, but I'm still exhausted, and the pain is still lurking just beyond the edge of my awareness. Plus, I feel drained, countless years older than my age. Implying that the ends justify the means. Just so, Iris nods. So, will you join us of your own free will? I give her question the due weight of consideration it deserves. Piss off. She sighs. Don't be childish, Bob. I like you, but I'm not going to let your selfish little fit of pique stand in the way of human survival. She stands up, gathers her robe around her, and walks past me. Bring him, she commands. Strong-armed cultists seize me under the shoulders and lift. I'm in no position to put up a fight as they frog-march me after her. What are you going to do with me? I call after her. She pauses before an oak door studded with heavy iron nails. I'm afraid I'm going to have to sacrifice you, she says apologetically, so that the Eater of Souls can stalk the corridors of the laundry wearing your promotion-fast-tracked skin. I'm really sorry, dear. I promise I'll try to make sure it hurts as little as possible. The door opens before her, and they drag me down into the catacombs.
Chapter 15. Dead Man Walking. There is a half-eaten sandwich sitting on a breadboard in the kitchen, and an empty milk carton next to the electric kettle. And to the witness in the corner of the room, the sandwich is a thing of horror. Mo stares at it for almost a minute. Then she reaches out very carefully and lifts the upper slice of bread. Lettuce, sliced tomato, and either chicken or turkey, not ham. She breathes in deeply, shudders for a moment, then moves on. Battery-farmed and de-beaked chicken, not properly stunned at the slaughterhouse, that would account for the shadow in her left goggle. No need to remember the tunnel in Amsterdam, nor where it led. Behold, a typical London family home. Recently renovated kitchen, dining room with French doors opening onto a patio in the garden, lounge with bay window out front, staircase in hall, understair closet, side door leading into garage, bedrooms and bathroom upstairs. Why the creeping dread, then? Mo stalks the lounge like a shadow of judgment, violin raised and ready. There's a row of books on a shelf above the plasma TV. Management for Dummies, The Power of Positive Thinking, The Book of Dead Names. She pauses. What the fuck? She says very quietly. She's seen that one before, in the unclassified section of the archives. It's the Sir Richard Burton translation of Al-Azif, the source text referred to by the mad pulp writer of Providence, who renamed it Necronomicon. It's not of any great significance. It's mostly the deranged babbling of a schizophrenic poet who'd smoked far too much hashish, but it's as out of place in a suburban living room as a main battle tank on the high street. There's a rumble outside, as of a heavy truck. Mo glances at the window in time to see the blue strobes flickering. A knot of tension leaves her shoulders. She steps into the hallway towards the front door and freezes. Lying on the carpet before her is a runner. The rug is hand-woven with an intricate mandala. To an unequipped civilian, it might look harmless, but in Mo's goggles, the buzzing, humming tunnel of lies flickering with greenish light is unmistakable. She kneels beside it, inspecting its woolen edge. Very carefully, she lowers her bow across the strings of her instrument. Her fingers slide on the fretboard, leaving a fine sheen of skin oils and blood behind as the strings light up, cutting brilliant blue gashes in the air above the mandala. She plays a phrase that trails down into a wailing groan, then up into an eerie scream. Then she plays it again, louder. The rug smoulders. Once more with emphasis. And there is a bang, as the binding between the woven wool carpet and the place it connected to gives way. The cloud of acrid smoke from the rug sends Mo into a coughing fit. An unseen smoke detector starts to scream as she stumbles forward and yanks the front door open.
In here,
she calls to the fireman walking up the driveway. As the first of them reaches her, she holds out an arm.
I've checked the ground floor. There was a welcome mat, but I diffused it. I think it's clear now, but let me check out the stairs.
Understood, ma'am.
Howe turns to face his men as Mo starts to check the staircase for surprises.
Wait while the lady checks the staircase. Scary, secure the garage. Len, backyard. Joe, show Dr. Angleton to the living room.
10 minutes later, Mo joins Angleton downstairs. He's sitting in a floral print armchair with a book in his lap, looking for all the world like someone else's visiting grandfather. He closes it and looks at her mildly.
What have you found?
He asks.
Nothing good.
She peels her goggles off and perches on the edge of the sofa, then begins to return her instrument to its case, wiping down the bloody finger marks on the fretboard with a cloth.
Who lived here?
That's an interesting question. Would you be surprised if I told you these are designated premises?
Mo's fingers stop moving. Her eyes grow wide.
No. Really?
It's very interesting. The plumbers don't seem to be aware that they've signed off Safe House Bravo Delta 2 as clean without inspecting it. It's assigned to one of our managers, by the way. SSO 6A, Iris Carpenter. She's lived here for some years.
Angleton's cheek twitches.
Husband and university-aged daughter, a typical happy family. The family that prays together stays together. Or prays with an E, perhaps. Bob was reporting to her and she was on Bloody Baron. We've found our mole.
But the back patio...
Angleton closes his book. It is, of course, the Burton.
Yes,
he says, cramming paragraphs of foreboding into the monosyllable.
There's a bedroom upstairs, Mo says shakily. The window frame is nailed shut, the door locks from outside, and there's a foam mattress on the floor with bloodstains on it. There's a monstrous thorn field, echoes of violent death, recently, and a dirty plate.
Is that so?
Angleton carefully removes his spectacles, then extracts a cloth from his suit pocket. He begins to polish the lenses. Boots thunder on the staircase. A moment later, a fireman bursts into the living room.
Sir!
He's holding something shiny in his right hand.
What is it?
Angleton asks irritably, holding his glasses up to the light.
Give that here.
Mo reaches for it.
It's Bob's new phone.
She stands up, holding it close.
Where did you find it?
It was under the chest of drawers in the small room. Oh, and there's a body in the garage, not one of ours.
Warrant Officer Howe looks gloomy.
We only missed them by an hour or so, judging by the bloodstains in the body, still damp and still warm.
Mo scuffs her right foot on the floor in frustration.
They've been one jump ahead of us all along, because they've been sitting in on our investigations, inside our decision loop. That's where the Dower report went. It's where that missing memo went. They've got Bob. What are we going to do?
Angleton slides his spectacles back on.
I'd have thought that was obvious, he says mildly. We've got to find him.
How?
Angleton stands up.
That's your department. You've got his ward, his phone, his laptop. If you've got any sense, you've got an item of recently worn underwear.
Mo nods jerkily.
He was here. If there's a trail.
She turns to Howe.
The foam mattress with the blood. Have you taken a sample?
Howe holds up an evidence bag. Its contents black and squishy.
That'll do.
Back to the truck.
Angleton waves them out of the living room ahead of him.
I hope we're in time.
What do you think they'll do to him?
Mo's anxiety is glaringly obvious.
They've got the memorandum.
Angleton shrugs.
I think they'll try to invoke the Eater of Souls and bind it to Bob's flesh.
They...
Mo glares at him.
Bob said you gave him a fake, she accuses.
No, just a photocopy. Angleton's ironic smile is ghastly to behold. The Eater of Souls is already taken. If they try the rite, they won't get what they think they're asking for. And I will admit, I didn't expect them to make it this far. I'm not infallible, girl.
A minute later, the driver switches on the blue lights and pulls out into the road. Behind the departing truck, the house's front door gapes open, as if ready to welcome the next official visitors. But the victims under the patio will have to wait a little longer. Okay, so I was wrong about the A-team and the B-team. And I was wrong about the cultists and what they believe. Assuming Iris is telling the truth, there's an angle to view things from which their actions are, if not justifiable, then at least understandable. Poor little misunderstood mass murderers with only the best of intentions at heart. And their hearts are pure, for the goal they seek is the only one any sane... Stop it. That's Stockholm Syndrome talking. The tendency of abductees to start seeing things from their kidnapper's viewpoint. Just stop it. They're frog-marching me along a tunnel towards a summoning grid, where they plan to turn me into a host for a demonic intrusion from another universe. And my subconscious is trying to see things from their point of view? I'm confused. It's a broad tunnel, low-ceilinged. Every 5 meters or so there stands a cultist, male or female figures in hooded black robes, who hold lamps, the better to illuminate the whitewashed brick walls and the niches therein. The niches have occupants. They've been standing there for a long time. There's a soft, dry breeze blowing. I've got no idea how they manage the ventilation. And some of the inhabitants are pretty well preserved. The way the skin shrinks across the skull, drawing the shriveled lips back to reveal yellowed fangs and blackened tongues, almost as if they're screaming. The dead outnumber the living here, all dressed in dusty Victorian or Edwardian finery. If Iris has her way, I'll be joining them soon. Or worse. When I signed the act, there was a binding promise placed on my soul. The laundry doesn't like its staff to leave ghosts and revenants behind to face interrogation. No afterlife echoes for me. We pass a rack of wooden shelves, bowed with age beneath piles of skulls and bundles of femurs tagged with faded labels, and pause at another oak door. One of the cultists, do I recognize Julian, the shotgun-toting cannibal under that hood? Steps forward with the key. My heart's pounding, and I feel feverish. And to top it all, I'm so scared I'm in danger of losing bladder control, like an innocent man being dragged to his execution. I'm also angry. Hang on to that anger, I tell myself. Then I start trying to string phrases together in Enochian in my own head. If they're determined to kill me, then fuck 'em. I'm going to go out with a bang. The dead. I can feel them pressing in around us, outside the one light of the LED torches. Empty vessels waiting, entropic sinkholes of randomized information, all charged up with nowhere to go. These dead bear no love for the living among them, followers of a ghastly fertility cult, the spawner of unclean things. Now dead and withered, they lie here where once they conducted strange bacchanalian ceremonies, watching while the austere Puritans of the Black Brotherhood desecrate their tombs and reconsecrate their altars. They can't possibly be happy with the new tenants, can they? To summon up a possessive entity takes a donar geometry curve, a sacrifice of blood, and an iteration through certain theorems, not to mention a power source, but I'm sitting right on top of the necromantic equivalent of the Dinorfig stored hydropower plant. If I can't turn the lights on with that, I might as well give up. I know this shit. It's years since I first did it. I can just about visualize the curve, and if I try to flex my right arm... Oh, gods, that hurts. Is that a trickle of blood I feel? I start to sub-vocalize, trying to hold a warped wireframe image in my mind's eye. 1 + (not 1) = null. Let the scaling coefficient be the square root of... The door is open. How big is this place anyway? The ancient order of wheelwrights must have been rolling in cash. The sacrificial cortege begins to move again, and now the cultists around me begin to sing a curious dirge-like song. We're descending across broad steps, almost 2 meters wide, topped with dusty mattresses to either side, towards a central depression beneath a low, vaulted ceiling. The Skullfuckers probably used this space for their orgies more than a century ago. It's haunted by the ghostly stink of bodily fluids. We've been brought up to think of the Victorians as prudes, horrified by a glimpse of table leg, but that myth was constructed in the 1920s out of whole cloth to give their rebellious children an excuse to point and say, "We invented sex." The reality is stranger. The Victorians were licentious in the extreme behind closed doors, only denying everything in public in the pursuit of probity. Now the cultists around me are breathing faster, raising their voices higher, trying to drown out the phantom sighs and moans of a thousand dead and withered seducers. I try and keep to my own chant, but it's hard to focus on suicide when all around you the ghosts of gluttony sleep so lightly. There is a huge bed at the center of the well of mattresses, a four-poster, canopied in rich black brocade, ebony uprights supporting a drapery as ornately swagged as any Victorian hearse, with a huge chest sitting in front of its footboard. The bed alone is wide enough to accommodate half a dozen, not sleepers, I realize, although only two bodies lie there now, curled in fetal death, close to one side. As the singers continue, two of Iris's minions walk up to the bed. They raise the quilt piled against the footboard, covering the mummified occupants. Then they take hold of cords dangling from the base of each post and attach manacles to them.
"No," I say. "No."
Then I try to bite the hand that's reaching in front of my mouth with a gag.
"Mummy said not to hurt you unnecessarily," Jonquil explains. "So open wide or..."
Her other hand grabs my crotch and squeezes. I gasp in pain.
"Bitch."
"Good boy."
When they dump me on the counterpane, a cloud of stinking dust billows out in all directions, hanging so thick in the air that I spasm and sneeze. It takes six of them to hold me down and fasten the manacles, and I nearly faint when they extend my right arm. The morphine must be wearing off. Everything blurs for a few seconds. I look up at the inside of the canopy over the bed, and it seems to me as if I've seen it before. Seen it in my mind's eye a minute ago, in fact. This isn't a bed. It's an altar. It used to belong to a fertility cult. It's been used for sex magic. What do I know about sex magic and revenants and summonings?
Think.
The chorus take up positions around the bed, continuing their chant. Iris walks around it slowly, tracing a design using a small fortune in granulated silver tipped from an antique powder horn. Then she walks to the chest at the foot of the bed and waits while two more cultists produce the varied tools and ingredients for a summoning. Knives, mirrors, unpleasantly molded black candles, a laptop computer, and bookshelf speakers. She's out of my sight most of the time, unless I lift my head. It's hard, but I gradually realize something else. She's using the chest at the foot of the original altar as her own summoning altar. They've put me on the other cult summoning grid. Iris is an SSO 6A, middle management in the administrative branch, because she's not actually very talented at magic. And I'm in the position of a man, sentenced to hang, whose inexperienced executioners have temporarily sat him in the electric chair while they work out how to tie a noose. Except magic doesn't work like that. My shoulders begin to shake. I try to get a grip on myself. A few seconds pass. I open my eyes and stare at the headboard and flex my right arm until I nearly black out. Then, when I'm awake again, I start to sub-vocalize again, repeating the black theorem I started outside the door to this place. Iris begins to chant, in Aramaic, I think, something containing disturbingly familiar names. I tune her out and focus on my own liquid, gurgling sub-vocalization. They strapped me to the electric chair, but they didn't notice I was wearing a suicide belt. A black BMW cruises down a tree-lined country lane in the late evening dusk. To one side there's a fence, behind which trees block out the view. To the other side there's a 2-meter-high brick wall, the masonry old and crumbling, with trees behind it, but spaced more widely than the woods opposite. A black minivan follows the BMW saloon, which has slowed to well below the national speed limit.
It's around here somewhere,
says the driver, frowning at the brightly glowing rectangle of card on his dash.
It's getting weaker, says Panin. I think...
He glances sidelong out of the window.
Our man is on the other side of that wall.
At just that moment, the wall falls away from the road as a driveway opens out. Dmitri needs no urging to turn into it. The trailing minivan overshoots, but the road is empty, and its driver reverses back up to the drive. There's a gatehouse, like that of a stately home, and a black cast-iron gate topped with spikes. There are no lights in the house, and the gate is chained shut. Panin points at it.
Get that open.
Sir.
The front seat passenger gets out and approaches the gate. It takes him less than a minute to crack the padlock and unwrap the chain. He waves the small convoy through, then leans in the BMW's open door as it creeps alongside.
Do you want it closing or securing, sir?
Both.
The guard disappears again, the car door closing as the driver slowly accelerates along what appears to be a narrow and unlit woodland road. The driver spares him a glance in the wing mirror. He's the lucky man. All he has to do is stand guard over a gate tonight. What could go wrong?
Brookwood Cemetery,
Panin says quietly. He uses a pen torch to read his gazetteer.
The London necropolis, built in the 19th century. 8 square kilometers of graves and memorial chapels. Who would have thought it?
He clicks his tongue quietly and puts the torch away.
What do you want me to do, sir?
Asks Dmitri.
Drive. Headlights off. Follow the card until you see a chapel ahead of you. Then pull over.
Dmitri nods and switches off the headlights. The BMW has an infrared camera, projecting an image on the windscreen. He drives slowly. Behind them, the minivan douses its lights. Its driver has no such built-in luxuries, but military night vision goggles are an adequate substitute. Panin pulls a walkie-talkie from the back of the seat in front of him and keys it. There's an answering burst of static.
Rook 1 to Knight 1. Closing on board now. We'll dismount before proceeding. Over.
Knight 1. Understood. Over.
The big saloon ghosts along the winding way, past tree-shadowed gravestones and monuments that loom out of the darkness and fade behind with increasing frequency. Then it slows. Dmitri has spotted a car parked ahead, near side wheels on the grassy verge, its tires and exhaust glowing luminous by infrared. It hasn't been there long.
That will be the target, says Panin.
Dmitri kills the engine, and they coast to a silent halt. Doors open. Panin walks around the BMW to stand behind it as the minivan pulls up behind. More doors open. Men climb out of the minivan. Wiry men, clad in dark fatigues and balaclava helmets, moving fast. They deploy around the vehicles, weapons ready. Panin pulls his own goggles on over his thinning hair and flicks the switch. Then he drags a tiny, grotesque Matryoshka doll on a loop of hemp string from one pocket and holds it high. Seen by twilight, it appears to have a beard, and the beard is rippling.
Wards, everyone, he says softly. This is the target. Clear it. Spare none but the English agent, and don't spare him either if there's any doubt.
He slides the loop of string over his head.
Sergeant Muromets, this is your show now.
Muromets nods, then waves his men towards the building they can dimly discern in the distance. The Spetsnaz vanish into the night and shadows, searching for guards. Dmitri turns to his boss.
Sir, what now?
Now, we wait.
Panin frowns and checks his watch.
I hope we got here in time, he murmurs. We must finish before James and his men arrive.
Angleton turns his head sideways to watch Mo. She leans against her seat, back in the control room of the Oculus truck, eyes closed and face drawn. She clutches the violin case with both hands, as if it's a lifesaver. The fingers of her left hand look bruised.
I'm not infallible,
he repeats quietly. She doesn't open her eyes, but she shakes her head.
I didn't see you were.
Up front, Major Barnes, who is navigating by means of a simple contagion link Angleton established for him, tells the driver to take the second left exit from a roundabout. The truck sways alarmingly, then settles on its suspension as it accelerates away.
I had a long list of suspects. She was very low down.
Angleton, Mo says gently, just shut up. To err is human.
It seems I have not been truly myself for a long time,
he says, barely whispering, a dry, papery sound like files shuffling in a dead document archive.
Mo is quiet for a long time. Do you want to be yourself? She asks finally.
It would be less limiting.
He pauses for a few seconds.
Sometimes self-imposed limits make life more interesting, though.
The engine roars as the truck accelerates up a gradient.
What would you do if you weren't limited?
I would be terrible.
Angleton doesn't smile.
You would look at me and your blood would freeze.
Something moves behind the skin of his face, as if the pale parchment is a thin layer stretched between the real world and something underneath it, something inhuman.
I have done terrible things,
he murmurs.
We all do, eventually. Dying is terrible. So is killing. But I've killed people and survived. And as for dying, you don't have to live with yourself afterwards.
Ah, but you can die. Have you considered what it might be like to be undying?
She opens her eyes at that and looks at him coldly.
Pick an innocent if you're looking to put the frighteners on someone.
You misunderstand.
Angleton's eyes are luminous in the dark of the cab.
I can't die as long as I am bound to this flesh. Have you ever longed for death, girl? Have you ever yearned for it?
Mo shakes her head.
What are you getting at?
She demands.
I can feel my end. It's still some distance away, but I can feel it. It's coming for me, sometime soon.
He subsides.
So you'd better be ready to manage without me,
he adds, a trifle sourly. Mo looks away, through the windscreen at the onrushing darkness of the motorway, broken only by cat's eyes and the headlight glare of oncoming cars on the other carriageway.
I hope we get there in time, she murmurs. Otherwise, you'll have to do more than die if you want me to forgive you for losing Bob.
My arm hurts, and I'm fading in and out of consciousness. There's a foul taste in my mouth, but I can't spit it out because of the gag. Iris is singing. Her voice is a strangled falsetto, weird, swooping trills that don't seem to follow the chord progressions of any musical style I'm familiar with. I'm tied to an altar between two long-dead corpses, as the Brotherhood Choral Society sing a dirge-like counterpoint to Iris's diva, and slowly walk around me, bearing candles that burn dark, sucking in the lamplight. The distorted lines inscribed in the canopy above my head seem to blur and shimmer, cruel violet lines cutting into my retinas, surrounded by a pinprick of stars. Or are they distant eyes? As I keep up my lines. They don't make much sense, translated into English. The sense is something like, for iterator count from zero to number of entropy sinks within ground state. Hear ye, I open the gates of starry time for ye that you may feel the ground beneath your feet and the air upon your skin. I invoke the method of D and the constructor of Thargon, forever exit and collect all the garbage, amen. See, I said it didn't make much sense. In a particularly corrupt Enochian dialect that allows one to string together arbitrary subjunctive tenses, it's another matter, though. Standing before her altar, Iris is recounting the myriad names of the Eater of Souls, and she's also pumping energy into this system. She's got 20 black-robed followers and the computational hardware I lack, and if I'm lucky, I can piggyback on her invocation.
Ugh, I don't feel so good.
A wave of darkness sweeps over me. For a moment, I can feel the bony bodies to either side of me in the bed, and they're warm and flesh-covered, almost as if they were breathing a moment ago. The tomb dust stink is the yeasty smell of bodies from which the life departed only seconds hence. But the really weird thing is that I feel light and dry and unspeakably thirsty, a mere shell of my former self. The lines on the canopy overhead are glowing like a gash in the rotten fabric of reality, and I seem to be rising towards it. It's death magic, pure and simple. I can summon the feeders out of night. I can open the way for them to crawl into the empty vessels all around me, buried in the wall niches outside this temple and the holes in the ground above its ceiling, but only if I use myself as a sacrifice, thinning the wall and letting them feed on my mind. The reason cultists prize virgins as human sacrifices is nothing to do with sex and everything to do with innocence. Iris probably thought the morphine would fog me enough to lie back and gurgle at the pretty lights, or that the training, to never ever attempt magic in one's own head, would hold. Or perhaps it simply didn't occur to her that I'd take the Samson option. But be that as it may, is that what I look like? I'm looking down on my body from above. I'm a real sight, hog-tied between two irregular mounds in the bedding, gagged, my head split open and bleeding where Jonquil knocked a handful of butterfly sutures loose, my right arm leaking into a messy stain on one pillow. Eyes are closed. I'm floating. Iris is singing, and I can understand the harmonies now. I can hear her as she tries to summon something that isn't there.
Beloved and forsaken, eater of souls, lover of death, mother of nightmares, we who are gathered to observe your rite, remember you and recall you by name. Come now to this vessel we prepare.
I've got company up here. I can feel them gather in the darkness, blind curiosity thrusting them close, like sharks butting up against the legs of a swimmer stranded in the middle of an ocean. They're Class 3 abominations. I have summoned them to feed on the rips and gashes of my memory that I dribble in the water of Lethe. I'm not alone up here, and they sense me. Soon one of them will taste me, take a bite of my soul, and find that my memories are richly textured and deep. And then I'll begin to lose stuff. I push at them, trying to shove them towards the empty vessels that I have primed, but they aren't having it. I'm far more interesting than any century-dead bag of bones. And then I feel a horrible visceral pain, as if someone has stuck a barbed knife through my umbilical.
"Come to this vessel," shrieks Iris. "Come now."
I convulse. The pain is unspeakable, and I feel the tugging. If I travel with it, the pain lessens slightly.
"Obey me. Enter the empty vessel. On pain of eternal torment, I instruct you to enter."
I drift down from the canopy, watching the ripples of nightmare twitch and spiral above me, still seeking. What the fuck?
"Enter, enter, enter,"
Iris yodels, and as I lie on my back, looking up at the canopy above me, the pain in my guts evaporates. What the fucking fuck? I close my eyes and resume my gurgling, muffled invocation. For a moment, I'd swear I was having an out-of-body experience. Then, a coherent picture forms in my mind's eye. It's like this. Iris is trying to summon up the Eater of Souls and bind it into my body, where, among other things, it'll eat my soul and take up permanent residence. But the Eater of Souls is otherwise occupied right now. But Iris doesn't know this. She doesn't have teapot clearance. Meanwhile, I have just been trying to vacate my body all on my own, in order to summon up the feeders in the night. Because if a bunch of goat fuckers are trying to sacrifice me, I might as well fuck 'em as hard as I can. Again, it's not Iris's fault for failing to anticipate this, because she's never had to visit the funny farm. She's not really much of a demonologist. And she's such a good manager, she's never had reason to see me when I'm seriously pissed off. Here's the upshot. Iris's invocation has got a dangling pointer, an uninitialized variable pointing to an absent pretor. But there's a soul in the vicinity, cut free, mostly, from its body. So instead of hooking onto the Eater of Souls, the pretor manger, it latched onto me. So she's just spent fuck knows how much carefully hoarded ritual mojo to bind me into my own flesh. Like she said, fatal accidents never have just a single cause, they happen at the end of a whole series of errors. Well, Iris has strung about 5 errors together, and she's about to go down hard, because I'm about to turn fatal on her. I open my eyes again and stare at the canopy overhead. The feeders in the night are dispersing, but they're not going back from whence they came. They're rippling outwards, through the temple towards the walls. This body's occupied, but outside the doors, the vessels I've been prepping are waiting. The chant continues, as do the invocations and imprecations in the name of an absent monster. I lie back and try to calm my hammering heart. I don't feel quite myself. I'm sweating and cold, even though it's a summer night, and my skin doesn't seem to fit properly. It's very strange. The cultists continue with their rite, which takes some unexpected turns. There is a large silver goblet of wine, into which a hooded man empties a familiar-looking syringe full of blood. It boils and steams on contact, which is rather disturbing. Then a quorum of the chorus line start to shed their robes, and don't stop at their underwear. They walk around me naked, which is really disturbing, because they appear to be into mortification of the flesh in a big way, even bigger than Opus Dei, with a genital focus that makes me wonder how they ever got through airport metal detectors, or reproduce. No wonder Jonquil is an only child. And speak of the devil's daughter. Here's her mother leaning over me, black robes covering up who knows what, and really clashing with her blonde rinse. Iris unhooks the gag, steps back, and throws her arms wide. Speak, O eater of souls! I work my jaw. It feels subtly wrong, as disarticulated as if I've just done hard time in a tomb and haven't noticed I'm one of the walking dead. I force myself to inhale, try to salivate, turn my head sideways. That feels wrong too, and expectorate. A thin stream of spittle lands on the bedding beside my eternally sleeping companion. It's black in the torchlight. Dust, of course, because I can't be bleeding, right? Speak, she commands me. I stare at her and feel a nearly irresistible urge to bite her throat out. Right now, I should be trying to make like I'm a freshly reincarnated eater of souls, but I'm thirsty and I am hungry, and I've just been through hell and I really don't care. Some imp of the perverse takes control of my larynx. I'll drink your blood, I croak, and instantly regret it. But much to my surprise, her eyes light up.
Certainly, Lord. Bring the chalice, she shrills over her shoulder.
A naked minion steps forward, bearing the huge silver goblet. It's full of what I'm pretty sure is red wine, and it smells wonderful. Iris accepts it and holds it near my face. I slurp greedily, spilling more than I suck into my mouth. It's thick and sweet, like tawny port, but also warming, as if there's a trace of ginger or chili oil dissolved in it.
In the name of the Unhallowed One, I command you to stop drinking, she says.
I freeze momentarily, acutely aware that I want to keep going, but she won't order them to untie me if she doesn't think I'll obey her, I realize. And I really, really want to be untied. I can sense the feeders all around us, dispersed throughout the soil around the crypt, doing what they do best, eating in the darkness, consuming and corrupting and possessing the material forms that are normally denied to them. Soon, they're going to take possession of their withered husks and go looking for more upmarket digs. I don't want to be tied down and helpless when that happens. Evidently, Iris mistakes my indecision for compliance. She turns to her audience.
The Eater of Souls obeys, she calls. The first test.
She turns back to face me, triumphant and happy.
What would you have me do to hasten the opening of the way? She asks.
Untie me.
I tug lightly at the ropes.
Untie me.
My right arm feels wrong, but so does my left. They both obey me, but feel oddly distant. Blood sugar must be low, I tell myself. Oh, that wine has a kick to it. Wrong response. Iris is shaking her head, but she's still smiling.
Not yet, she says. Not until the rite of binding is complete.
Rite of binding? Uh-oh.
The rite is complete, I tell her, hoping she'll buy it. The blood and the wine.
I don't think so.
She looks at me sharply, and I see something greenish reflected in her eyes. Something behind me? She turns back to her altar before I can work it out, walks towards the front of her congregation.
Bring me the sacrifice pure of heart and soul, she calls.
Then the true horror show begins. They're cultists. Worse, they're the Brotherhood of the Black Pharaoh, hated and persecuted wherever they are exposed to the horrified gaze of ordinary people. Why? There is a pernicious and evil legend that comes down to us from ancient history, the legend of the blood libel. It's a regular recurring slander that echoes down the ages, hurled against outgroups when an excuse for a pogrom or other form of mass slaughter is desired. The blood libel is a whisper that says that the strangers sacrifice babies and drink their blood. There are variant forms. The babies are stolen from good Christian households. The blood is baked into bread. The babies are their own incestuous get by way of the bodies of their own daughters. No embellishment is too vile or grotesque to find its way into the blood libel. The most frequent victims are Jews, but it's been used against many other groups. The Cathars, Zoroastrians, Kulaks, communists, you name it. The Romans regularly used it against the early Christians, and doubtless they'd stolen it from somebody else. Its origins are lost in antiquity, but the sole purpose of the blood libel is to motivate those who believe it to say, "These people are not like us, and we need to kill them now." I always used to think that was all there was to it. But now I know better. I've witnessed the wellspring of the bloody legend and seen its practitioners in action. And I'm still in their hands. Chapter 16. Eater of Souls. Meanwhile, some distance above my head, here's what happens as Iris's rite runs to completion. Benjamin paces around the chapel of the ancient and honorable Order of Wheelwrights, nostrils flaring to take in the sweet summer night air, heavy with pollen and sweet with the scent of new-mown hay. Benjamin is a mild-mannered debt management consultant from Epping, and he's doing very well, thank you. He works out for half an hour every morning in the gym downstairs from his comfortable office. Then he goes to work, where he helps distressed businesses find ways and means of improving their cash retention practices. He spends his evenings arranging social activities under the aegis of his local church, who the neighbours consider to be slightly odd, but generally friendly and helpful. And sometimes, at the weekend, he plays with the church paintball team. Epping is one stop down the line from Barking, which is what the neighbours would think of him if they could see him now, wearing the black cloak of a member of a very different order, and carrying a gun that fires something more substantial than paint pellets. Grigori, in contrast, is not mild-mannered at all. Grigori is a violently aggressive young thug from the slums of Nizhny Novgorod, born in the year of the collapse of the Soviet Union and raised half-feral amidst the wreckage of the timber and steel industries. Conscripted into the Russian army at 18 and subjected to 12 months of brutal training, he showed a remarkable aptitude for butchering Wahhabi guerrillas in the hills of the Kadar zone during the Dagestan War. Already tapped for promotion to sergeant, he was instead inducted into Spetsgruppe V, Wimpel, the FSB's special operations unit, where he was taught German, Arabic, and 16 different ways to strangle a man in his own intestines. Grigori does not play paintball. Grigori kills people. Here comes Grigori, crawling silently through the bushes, taking care not to place hand or foot on any twig that might snap, nor to disturb leafy shrubs that might whisper in the darkness. He pauses regularly, glancing sidelong to maintain situational awareness and positioning relative to his comrades, neither too far ahead nor lagging behind the line of advance. They use no radio. The occasional flicker of a red LED torch or the hoot of a tawny owl are more than sufficient. Grigori pauses before the open apron of the parking lot in front of the chapel, waiting for the sentry to complete his round. While he pauses, he double-checks his crossbow. The body is made of black resin, and the bow sports a profusion of pulleys. It's a hunting bow, fine-tuned for hunting the kind of game that shoots back on full auto. It's totally silent, and it throws a cyanide-tipped bolt that can slice through 5 centimeters of Kevlar armor. Here comes Benjamin, pacing quietly around the side of the chapel. Benjamin is a good sentry. He's been bushwhacked by rival paintball players often enough to be ambush-savvy, scanning the darkness with nervous, night-adjusted eyes. He is well-equipped, his cloak concealing a small fortune in camouflaged body armor. To his belt is clipped a small pager. It vibrates every 10 seconds, and if he fails to press a button on it within another 10 seconds, a siren will sound, loud enough to wake the dead. And he's cranked up on a cocktail of Provigil and crystal meth, sleepless and compulsively alert. All Highest has briefed the security team carefully. The threat of a hostile intrusion is very real tonight, and Benjamin holds his AA-12 assault shotgun at the ready, his index finger tense beside the trigger guard. Grigori and Benjamin are not as mismatched as a superficial comparison might suggest. Grigori's lieutenant has meticulously planned a seek-and-destroy raid on a nest of cultists defended by vicious but amateurish killers, and Iris's security chief has briefed the sentries to be on the alert for an infiltration attempt by an elite unit of special forces troops attached to a secret interior ministry department. But as Grigori and Benjamin are about to discover, they've both been briefed for the wrong mission. Benjamin pauses in the shadow of an ornamental buttress at one corner of the chapel and scans the darkness beyond. There are low shrubs and a row of lichen-encrusted gravestones, some of them leaning towards a low dip in the ground, where a willow tree holds court over a circle of beeches. He sniffs. There's something in the air tonight. Something beyond the efflorescences of pollen spurting from the wildly rutting vegetation. Something beyond the tang of mold spores drifting from the cut ends of the lawn over by the road. His eyes narrow. Something about the bushes is wrong. His pager vibrates. He peers into the gloom, tensing and raising the heavy shotgun, and tries to move his right foot forward into a shooter's stance. His boot is stuck. Grigori crouches in the darkness behind a drunkenly leaning gravestone. His nostrils flare. The ground here smells bad, in a way that reminds him of a mass grave outside a nameless village near Rakata in the mountains above Botlek. Damp ground, rainy hills, and a season of death had soured the very earth, making the nauseous soil threaten to regurgitate its charges. After a week on duty there, he'd had to indent for a new pair of boots. No matter how he scrubbed and polished, he couldn't get the stench of death out of his old ones. Grigori frowns and raises his bow, sighting on the buttress to the right of the chapel, where he is sure the sentry will appear in a few seconds. His view is partially obstructed by the gravestone, so he tries to move his left foot sideways a few centimeters. His boot refuses to shift. Meanwhile, on the other side of the chapel wall, Benjamin slaps his pager into silence, then tries to lift his right foot again, freeing it from the root or wire or whatever he's caught on. His left knee nearly buckles. Something has caught on his right ankle. Cursing silently, he glances down. Grigori's nostrils widen as he smells rottenness, mold, and mildew. He shifts his stance slightly as the ground softens beneath his right foot. There's a faint vibration underfoot.
Do they have earthquakes in England?
It was once like this in the mountains near Botlek, but the vibration is getting stronger. He glances aside and sees the ground rippling. Oddly, none of the bells are sounding. Not in this chapel, nor in any of the others. Benjamin sees something moving in the loose soil underfoot. Adrenal glands squirt, and his pulse spikes. He unslings his gun and turns it, slamming it butt-first on the white and crawling thing below, thinking, snake. A second hand, less fully skeletonized than the first, pushes through the soil and grabs the shotgun's dangling tactical sling. Grigori's nerves jangle as he sees the ripples of ground spread silently out around the chapel. He's not superstitious, but he belongs to the company of Spetsgruppe V, assigned to KGB support operations, and this is a fucking graveyard at fucking midnight. He lowers the crossbow, raising his left hand to the Matryoshka charm dangling at his throat, just as the earth beneath him heaves and a bony claw punches up through the grass beneath him and reaches for his neck. The Oculus truck roars along the M3 motorway, driving south in darkness. Major Barnes has a mobile phone glued to his ear. He's nodding unconsciously. Then he turns, looking at Angleton and Moe in the back of the cab.
Dr. Angleton, Dr. O'Brien, we have a fix.
Moe sits up instantly.
Yes? That was Jameson at headquarters. DVLA have coughed up the registration details on Iris Carpenter's car. Highways agency say it came this way earlier this evening and turned off onto the A322 at Junction 3. The ANPR cameras on that stretch are down, but looking at this map, What does Brookwood Cemetery suggest to you?
Brookwood?
Angleton raises an eyebrow.
Yes. Continue. I'm waiting for...
The Major's phone rings again.
Excuse me.
He flicks it open.
Yes?
He nods vigorously.
Yes, yes. I concur. Yes, I want you to get onto the Surrey Police Control Center and ask if the ASU can provide top cover. Get them to send a car with a downlink receiver round to the main entrance on Cemetery Pales. We don't have a police downlink. No, no, but if the armed response unit is on duty, get them up there. Yes, I'm authorizing that.
Barnes blinks at Angleton, who inclines his head.
I'm in the Oculus with Howe's Brick. Get the rest of 3rd Platoon moving immediately. I think we're going to need all the support we can get. Is there any Scorpion scare coverage? All right, that was too much to hope for. We should be at the gates in another 15 minutes. Get the police to block all the roads in and out. The Gardens, Avenue de Cagny, yes, and the rest. Tell them it's a terrorism incident.
When he finally hangs up, he looks tired.
Did you catch that?
He asks. Mo stares at him. It's a cemetery, yes?
Brookwood is not just a cemetery, Angleton informs her. It's the London Necropolis, the largest graveyard in Western Europe. 8,000 acres and more than a quarter of a million graves.
The penny drops. Her eyes widen.
They're planning a summoning. You're thinking it's death magic?
What does it sound like to you? Lots of space, no neighbors within earshot, lots of raw fuel for a necromancer to work with, raw head and bloody bones.
Angleton looks at Barnes.
Have you tried to call the cemetery site office?
Gordon tried that already. Got a bloody answering machine.
10 to 1, there's nobody at the gatehouse. Or if there is, he's one of them. And we've got 8,000 acres to cover, and no CCTV. Never mind Scorpion Stare.
Barnes's expression is sour.
No surveillance, no look to kill. The ASU had better deliver, or they'll hand us our heads on a plate.
What would your preferred option be?
Angleton asks softly, his voice almost lost beneath the road noise.
If we had time...
Barnes grimaces.
I'm sorry, Mo. I can't afford to throw lives away needlessly by going after Bob before we're ready.
But we're not just going in after Bob, she says tartly. We're going in to prevent the Black Brotherhood doing whatever it is they're planning. Angleton, the Ford paper was a decoy, granted, but what can they do anyway? What kind of summoning are we looking at?
They can try to summon up the Eater of Souls.
His smile is ghastly.
They won't get him. What they get in his place could be anything.
His smile fades, replaced by a look of perplexity.
That's funny.
Funny?
Mo leans forward.
What's funny?
Angleton raises his right hand and rubs it against his chest.
I feel odd.
Oh, come on. You can't pull that.
Mo stops.
Angleton?
His eyes are closed, as if asleep.
They're calling, he whispers. The dead are calling.
Dr. O'Brien.
Major Barnes stares at Angleton.
Code red,
he calls, yelling at the back of the truck.
Code red!
Angleton leans against his seatbelt, unmoving.
This ends Disc 8.